Welcome to Sidebars, Kilpatrick Townsend's limited podcast series focused on women in patent law. I'm April Isaacson, a patent litigator and partner in the San Francisco office.
And I'm Kim Davis, a patent prosecutor and partner in the Atlanta office. We're here to discuss the gender gap in the patent bar and have candid conversations with female patent practitioners on their career paths. Welcome back to Sidebars. Okay, listeners, I'm extremely pleased to introduce our guest, Dr. Arlene Simon. Dr. Simon is, how should we say this, multi-talented, for lack of a better word. She's the CEO of Abby Invents, which is a K-12 invention education company designed to inspire kids everywhere to continue to invent, to start the process and continue. She is also the author of a series of books also entitled Abby Invents. By way of training, Dr. Simon is a biomedical engineer. She obtained her BS in chemical and biomolecular engineering from Georgia Tech, right here in Atlanta, Georgia, and her PhD in macromolecular science and engineering from the University of Michigan. Dr. Simon is currently a platform architect in the Health and Sciences Group of Intel Corporation. Prior to that, she served as a systems engineer in Intel's Data Center Engineering and Architecture Group. She was also a senior R&D engineer at Becton Dickinson. Dr. Simon is actively engaged in her community, serving as an if-then ambassador with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. In this role, she empowers middle school girls to pursue a STEM career. Such valuable work. The list truly goes on, but I wanted to spend a minute, just a minute, reading the first paragraph of your summary, Dr. Simon, which I think speaks perfectly to the heart of your work. Blessed to have three careers I love. One day I'll figure out how to combine them all: biomedical engineering, writing STEM children's books, and teaching K-5 educators ways to bring invention education into the classroom. This is the part I love. My mission is to inspire kid inventors everywhere. Dr. Simon, welcome to Sidebars.
Thank you for this lovely introduction, Kim. It's always remarkable hearing somebody reading my bio. I'm like, who is this person? Thank you for inviting me to speak and share my story with your audience today.
Absolutely. Thank you for accepting, first of all. So listeners, by way of background, Dr. Simon was kind enough to accept our invitation. We actually were fans of hers, right? We've heard her speak before the patent office, receiving awards there, and we were so thrilled. Our wonderful marketing team, everyone here knows Christina. You've heard Christina before. Christina found a way to make it happen. So thank you so much to everyone for doing what we needed to get you here with us.
I kind of feel like we're like Oprah got the big guest, right?
I don't know if I'm Oprah level yet.
Well, if you're not, you soon will be. I'm very confident in that.
Absolutely. So the way we typically start these, Dr. Simon, we ask this question. It's a teaser question of, well, what made you interested in patent law? But I'm going to shift it because patents is only a small part of everything that you do, right? So you're super involved, of course, in the invention aspects of it. You are a trained engineer who's actually still practicing as an engineer, and you're doing all of these great things in the community. So we're going to open your question a little bit more, even more open-ended. I want to hear your story, Dr. Simon's story of starting out. What was your background and how did you get to where you are now?
Okay, well, I'm going to try to keep it brief. I grew up in a very small Caribbean island called Dominica. And what I've been told by my parents and my extended family is that I was just a ball of insatiable curiosity, a true questioner asking why and how. And there were three people who played an influential role in raising me. So my mom, my dad, and my stepmom. And when you learn about them, you realize that my talents and my personality is really a blend of all three of them. Now that I'm older, I have a deep appreciation on how they co-parented me so seamlessly. My dad is a civil engineer, and so from him, I was introduced to science. And I have his analytical skills and engineering know-how. My stepmom has a deep, deep love for books and reading. So as a child, whenever we couldn't find her, we knew that she was on the balcony curled up with a book, or maybe falling asleep and the book reading her, but she was usually with a book. And she worked briefly as a medical transcriptionist when we moved to the United States. And that was probably how I got introduced to healthcare. And my mom, from her, I have her compassion and her deep passion for educating. She's an elementary educator. Growing up, she was a preschool teacher. Then she became a primary school teacher. And today she's a principal. And so from her, I just loved kids and loved teaching. And so when you think about it, it's almost as if the three of them circled around a giant cauldron and poured all these bits of them, and then out popped me. And so that is really my journey of beginning. I wanted to be a teacher for as long as I could remember, following in my mom's footsteps and my paternal grandmother, because she's a principal. And even, you know, remembering me as a little girl, the only game I ever played with my dolls was pretend school. I would come home from school and I would line up my dolls on the foot pedal of my great-grandmother's sewing machine. I don't know if you know these old school Singer machines where they're sitting on a table and you have the foot pedal, which is like, I don't know, 18 inches wide and 12 inches, I guess, long or something. So my dolls would be lined up on this foot pedal. And my dolls, each of them had a backpack because my great-grandmother taught me how to sew. And so my backpacks were made from old jeans that I sort of designed my old backpacks. And inside my backpacks were handmade exercise books for my dolls, like labeled English and math and social studies and science, like the subjects I was learning at school. And I would teach my dolls what I learned at school that day. And so I always wanted to be a teacher. There's just this desire of when I learn something, I just have to share it. I can't keep it inside. I don't know. I just need to get it out. And so that's why I'm so involved today in invention education and you know, talking to girls about STEM. As soon as I learn something, I just need to share it. And so that's really how my journey started.
So the dolls, were they receptive to the different lessons that you put in their backpacks?
I like to think so, you know, oddly, and my mom thought that was hilarious, but oddly, my pretend school, there were the bright students and the not so bright students. And my mission as a pretend teacher was to make sure that the not so bright students learned how to spell and learned how to do arithmetic. I have no idea. I had a very vivid imagination. And when I outgrew playing with dolls, there were days when I remember my primary school would end at 1 p.m. and my mom's school would end at 3:30 p.m. So if I timed the bus ride perfectly, I could get home, change out of my school uniform, and then run down the village to my mom's school when there was a break time, like an afternoon break. And I would tell her, you know, all the cool things I learned about my favorite teacher was Miss Robinson in grade 7. So Miss Robinson would teach us how to do long division with a dance and a song. And my mom would say, well, why don't you go teach, you know, my students? And then I would teach them the song for long division and the dance. And, you know, there was a song for how do you spell words with I before E and E before I. And so my mom would just let me just, know, offload everything to her class. And so that's just how I fell in love with education. Yeah.
You're probably too young to remember Schoolhouse Rock, but it sounds like you almost made up your own version of Schoolhouse Rock to teach lessons. That's really great.
Maybe.
So, Dr. Simon, I'm intrigued now. Tell me why and I'm calling it a shift, but I know it's not a shift because it came full circle, but the route of the biomedical engineering versus that of an education-related major.
Well, so in Dominica, many of the people I met, of course, my teachers, you know, my mom's a teacher, my dad's mom is a teacher. So my circle was educators. And so again, you know, if you can see it, you can be it. So that's what I saw. And that's who I wanted to be. And when I moved to the United States, I became aware of just how many things you could be. So Dominica basically gave me or showed me that I could be anything that I wanted to be. And when the United States basically introduced me to opportunities and gave me opportunities to be all that I can be. So when I moved to the United States, and now I'm deciding to be a chemistry major in chemistry, because in high school, I really loved chemistry. That was my jam, chemistry. So I figured I would be a chemistry teacher. And then at Georgia State University, I joined the chemistry club. And one day, a chemical engineer in my freshman year, he gives a seminar talk. And he says with a degree in chemical engineering, he could never be bored. He could work in cosmetics. He could work in pharma. He could work in automotive. And I'm thinking, what? Like, one degree makes you do all these things, and I don't really know what I want to be. I thought I could be a teacher, but now there's chemical engineering and pharma and cosmetics. What? I don't know. So I came home and I told my dad, I want to be a chemical engineer. Now, at this point, I think my dad was getting a little bit tired of me because every month I learned something new. First, it was I could do chemical biology or forensics or biochemistry, or maybe I can go to pharmacy school. I don't know. I'm just seeing all these things and I just want to be everything. And so I became a chemical engineer. I went to Georgia Tech and I got to do internships like at companies like Dow Corning and organic light emitting diodes, you know, the displays and in televisions and computers. And I got to do undergraduate research, something I never even considered doing before. And now I'm at Georgia Tech, and the biomedical engineering building is right next to the chemical engineering building. And every day I walk past it, I see these really vibrant images of the brain and cells, and the cells are stained in colors of greens and reds. And I'm like, wow, this looks really cool. And my classes, you know, I'm learning about healthcare applications for engineering. And I'm like, what? I didn't even know there was such a thing as biomedical engineering. And my stepmom is working as a medical transcriptionist. I am working part-time at CVS as a pharmacy. And I'm just like, oh my God, this world, there's so many cool things. And so I decide, okay, let me explore now biomedical engineering. And so that's when I decided to get a doctorate in a biomedical engineering discipline.
Well, you said earlier that it was in Dominica that you realized that you could pretty much do anything. What was it other than your father, your stepmother, and your mother that made you believe that that was the case?
That's a great question. So I went to an all-girls high school. And there's something about an all-girls school. Girls are the center stage. You know, we are the class prefects. We are the athletes. We are the science rock stars. Our teachers are primarily women. Our principal is female. So there's never a feeling that I can't do something. All my friends are girls. And Dominica, in fact, made it special, too, because we have the first female prime minister in the Caribbean, Dame Eugenia Charles. And so when you have such a role model that people call her the Iron Lady, I mean, there's no ceiling of what you can be. And plus, Dominica is a predominantly Black nation. We also have indigenous population, the Carib Indians, but predominantly Black. And so I grew up knowing that, you know, whatever it is I want to do, I can do. It's just a matter of exposure of what else can I do. But there was never a feeling of doubt of my potential. It's just not knowing what path to take.
I went to a women's college, so I very much completely understand with you of the women in every role and how much it empowers, really, is what it is that, yep. And it goes to your if then, right? If you can see it, you can be it. And that is a mantra that we have on the podcast. I know Kim and I talk about it all the time. I think that's really wonderful. And one more question too about Dominica. I read that you were inspired to do some of your first experiments with your mom and that you loved being out in nature. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So Dominica is called the Nature Isle of the Caribbean. So, you know, think lush green forest, the bluest of the blue ocean in the Caribbean Sea. And my mom always has had a flower garden. It just keeps getting better and better every year. And in the garden, there was this species of caterpillar called the frangipani caterpillar. It has black and neon yellow stripes. It looks really beautiful. And as a kid, I mean, it's just so pretty. How can a caterpillar be so pretty? And so I just wanted to know more about this caterpillar. Does it turn into a moth? Does it turn into a butterfly? And I would just put it in a jar with leaf and, you know, some droplets of water, cover that with saran wrap and, you know, wait for it to turn to whatever it turned to. So I was very disappointed because it turned into a moth. But that was that was my introduction to different species and, you know, just learning from observation, learning from doing. The phase where the caterpillar is in the pupa phase is very boring. Nothing happens. And as a child, you know, those days feel very long and weeks. And I'm like, is it dead? Like, what is happening? So that, I think, was the hardest part, was just waiting for something to happen. And then imagine my disappointment. I was expecting a multicolored butterfly. And then it's like a brown moth that emerges.
So a question for you, similar to April, I guess if you put April and me together, we would come up with you. She went to an all women's college. I went to an HBCU, right? So my friend set, of course, is full of, Xavier was really big. I went to Xavier University of Louisiana, really big on science degrees. So tons of pharmacists and medical doctors and researchers in my network. But then that culture shock happened when I moved to Atlanta and went to Emory for my PhD. You went from a country with everyone looking like you, right? And then you moved to Atlanta, maybe not as big of a shock there, somewhat, though, I'm sure there was, knowing the schools that you went to. And then Michigan. Tell us about, you see where I'm going with this. So tell us about I'll just leave it at that. Tell us about it.
That's a good question. Moving from Dominica to Atlanta was easier because Atlanta has a very big Black population. And even more so, the path felt easier or at least, you know, gradual for me because I went to Georgia State University and that is, you know, very diverse.
Yes.
Georgia Tech, not so much. So that was my beginning of a culture shock because now I was in engineering. And so there are less women in the class, less minorities. And Georgia Tech was hard for me. Let's say it that way. The work was difficult. First of all, I loved chemistry and I did not realize that chemical engineering did not have as much chemistry as I envisioned. And so I almost felt tricked a little bit by this chemical engineer who sold me on the magic of chemical engineering. It was the first time in my life where I really, really had to study to make sure that I got a good grade. And you know, I had to learn about teachers grading on curves, and that concept was very foreign to me. How is it that a 60 is a B? Like, what does that mean? Why are you making a class so difficult? So that was challenging. Michigan also tricked me a little bit when they recruited me, because Michigan plans their recruiting in March, and I think they choose the one warm March weekend. And so I go to Michigan for a grad school visit, and I'm like, what? Like, this looks great. What's everybody talking about? Snow. There's snow on the ground, but it's melted. And if I have a winter coat, of course I can be warm. I mean, it's warm inside. I have a scarf. And then I get to Michigan and we have polar vortex with negative 36 degrees. And I'm like, that was not on the brochure.
Oh,
but I really did love I loved my University of Michigan experience, you know, go blue. I think I found my way into a great lab. My lab was very inclusive, very diverse. My advisor was truly a mentor. He was the one who sought me out to join his lab. In my first semester at University of Michigan, you have a semester before you choose who your PhD advisor is going to be. And I'm the first person in my family to have a PhD, so I didn't really know the process. I just knew that this was the next step because, again, I was curious about biomedical engineering and what it had to offer. And my professor, Dr. Takayama, would see me on campus and say, when are you going to join my lab? You know, a place for you. And I'm like, why does this guy just keep asking me this thing about joining his lab? Has he seen my resume? Like, what does he think I can do? And then I would meet all these other professors, but nobody sort of had so much joy of wanting me to join the lab. It was just like normal. Like, yeah, this is what we do, tissue engineering. But Dr. Takayama would see me and wave and say, hey, Arlene, I haven't seen you by the lab. When are you going to come? I'm like, okay, I guess I'll give it a try. And I go to join his lab. And I mean, he just took me under his wings. I mean, he was the first inventor I ever met. And before him, I never thought about inventing. I thought inventor was just, you know, an old white guy with a lab coat and glasses like Albert Einstein. And here is this young Japanese professor with patents telling me that my work is patentable, that I'm creative, that he's giving me freedom to read this book and figure out what research path I want to take. I'm being open and vulnerable to him that I don't really know how to start. I haven't really done that much mammalian cell research. I've done stuff at Georgia Tech with plants and corn. But if you think I can do it, then sure, I will give it a go. And he made sure to give me postdoctoral mentors who I could shadow when my first project wasn't working and I thought I was a complete utter failure and I thought he was going to be so disappointed in choosing me. He just flipped it around and I sat in his office near to tears thinking that this man was going to tell me, made a mistake, you need to leave. And instead he says, it's research. The first project, I never really know if that's going to work. I just wanted to try it to see if that was feasible, but I think you've done enough. And it shows that what your results have shown is that, you know, my idea wasn't going to work. So we'll just try something else. And I'm like, what? Okay. and then we try something else. And, you know, experiments never worked the first time. I go back and I'm like, this one looks promising, but I don't know why I can't figure out this piece. And he goes, you know, maybe you're asking the wrong question. Maybe we spin the question around, like follow the data. If the data is telling you do X, then why are you trying to force fit it into Y? We can change the research question and just follow the data. Whatever the data is showing you, that's where we go. And I'm like, man, this guy is amazing. So yes, there was culture shock in University of Michigan. Yes, there were students who said that I only got accepted because of affirmative action. But having an advisor like Dr. Takayama, that trumped everything. Everything negative that I encountered, it was just like, it's all good. My advisor loves me and I'm doing great work. So you can take your comments and do whatever you want with it. But I have a good mentor. I don't know about you. So it's all good.
Oh, I love that. Love it. Love it. The power of having someone who affirms you, who believes in you. I know that resonates in you because I've read your books and we'll get to that later, but you definitely believe in affirming. Before we jump to the inventor part, because now I'm curious about your first invention and how you got there. April, I know you had a burning question there.
Oh, what I was thinking is, did you feel like you had imposter syndrome? Because we talk about these dialogues we have in our own heads, that we make up things and we're sometimes our own worst enemy. Just curious if that was a path that you went through.
I definitely had imposter syndrome. And I honestly didn't know that was a thing until a seminar talk at University of Michigan. I thought it was just me. And then it felt good knowing that I wasn't alone in that feeling of less than, that you're not good enough. Because in graduate school, you know, one of the success factors is getting publications. And I don't really hear people talking about patents, really. And so I felt like an imposter because I didn't have publications. I didn't get my first publication until my very last year. But I had filed two provisional patents before, but I never spoke about it because I didn't understand how important or just as good that was. I thought a publication was it because you always hear publish or perish. You never hear patent or something. Mm-hmm. And so I think most of my friends in grad school didn't even know that I had patents, because it was only after I left Michigan that I started, you know, being proud of becoming a patented inventor. Before that, it was just, oh, I don't have a paper yet. I don't know when I'm going to get published. You know, my last 2 years in my research lab, I was the only woman and I was the only Black person. So even then, you're like, all the guys have publications. I don't have one yet. When am I going to graduate? I don't know. Maybe I'm a failure. But then I had patents and I didn't even know that was such a great deal.
Well, and it's interesting because it goes to the point of the publish or perish, as opposed to focusing on the value of commercializing inventions and scientific research, which I know that Kim runs into because she does patent prosecution. Another question I had as well, we had a guest on our last podcast and he grew up on a reservation. So he's native and then went from there to MIT. And he talked about just feeling like, you know, he was definitely an outsider and sometimes feeling like he didn't belong and wanted to quit. Did you ever feel that way?
I did. My third year of grad school was the hardest. Yeah, that year was really hard. It was a year of your qualifying exams and not passing the first time, not passing the second time. And that has never happened to me in my entire academic career of failing at that level. And I remember calling my dad and be like, you know, I'm sorry if I feel a third time, you know, that's it. And I hope you don't feel disappointed that you've sacrificed so much for me and I may not be able to finish. But what really helped me, I guess, come out of that dark period was, again, my dad. I remember calling him one night. It was late. I was late in the lab. It was April or May, I think Memorial Day weekend, maybe just before that. I had spent very long hours in the lab, maybe like 8 a.m. to like 10 or 11 p.m. or something. I really wanted this experiment to work and just get some good data. And it's like nothing I tried felt like was working. And my dad, I called him really late. I didn't think he was going to answer the phone. And then he said, you know, why don't you come home tomorrow? I'm like, are you crazy? Like, I'm supposed to drive from Michigan to Atlanta? And he goes, no, just buy a ticket and just come home tomorrow. And I'm like, do you know how expensive it is to buy a last minute ticket from Ann Arbor to Atlanta? And he goes, Arlene, just buy the ticket and just come home. So I came home for a week and it was so good to get away from the lab and see, you know, Black people, see my family and sort of get, you know, reminded that I am loved and I can do it. And I remember that weekend, you know, my dad, he's really good at cooking. So he made me omelets and cocoa tea and it just brought me back to my childhood. And I came back to Michigan, you know, rested. And I mean, you wouldn't believe it, but that was all I needed because maybe the following weeks afterwards, then suddenly it clicked what wasn't working. I had the wrong reagent. And I think I just needed some time to get away and, you know, remind myself of who I was. And I passed my qualifying exams on the third try, but I did it. But yeah, there were times that it was lonely. I mean, it's cold. You miss your family. You lose family members and you get the call when you're in the lab. And so, yeah, it is challenging, especially being the first in your family, because nobody really understands. They're supportive. I have no doubt that they're supportive, but they don't. They try to understand and they send you prayers and, you know, words of affirmation. And that keeps you going. And they're friends who check in on you. God bless them. And yeah, you just have to, I guess, push on through and you come out from the other side stronger and better than you were when you started. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You said we wouldn't believe it when you returned, everything just turned around. And we absolutely believe it, because I think we've all lived exactly that moment where you just have to stop and refresh and be surrounded by the people who really love you and care for you. And so it's all making sense now, Dr. Simon. There's a portion of your book where you actually talk about taking that rest. Abby takes a rest with her work, but we'll get there. We'll get there. Listeners, I promise. I know I keep bringing up the book, but we will absolutely get there. Before we get there, you touched on the provisionals that you had that were filed while you were still a grad student, which I think is absolutely phenomenal. Do you want to share with us any of those inventions, maybe how that research turned into a patentable invention, and how you even thought that, okay, maybe I need to reach out to the commercialization office and see what we can do with this?
All my advisor, I'm just letting you know. So the research that I did in grad school was all about something based on aqueous two-phase system. So just as how you have oil and water that don't mix, where the oil is less dense, so it floats on the surface of the water. We worked with these two polymer solutions that dissolve in water, but they're immiscible in each other. And so we learned that we could sort of confine biomolecules in different phases. And maybe around my second or third year, we were searching for applications for this technology. And my advisor happened to attend a meeting where a cancer expert was speaking about a different problem that she had, which is, you know, she is a medical doctor doing research, and she's focused on bone marrow transplant rejection. So she explains that, you know, when a patient has cancer, they get chemotherapy. But chemotherapy may not just damage the cancer cells, but also the healthy cells. And then if the chemo damages the healthy cells, the physician requires for the patient to get something called a bone marrow transplant so that you can sort of replenish your healthy cells. But sometimes that bone marrow rejects your body. Usually we think of your body rejecting something, but sometimes the bone marrow is the one actually rejecting your body. And the outcome is this disease called graft versus host disease. So she was presenting and saying, you know, it's a challenge to then go have to give somebody an invasive biopsy, that we have to wait 100 days for us to know whether a person has graft versus host disease or not. Her work was all about identifying these different proteins in the patient's body that gets elevated when that rejection is taking place. But traditionally, how these proteins are measured is through a very long process that may take like 8 hours or so before you get the result. And it uses a lot of the patient's blood, you use a lot of reagents, and antibodies are really expensive in research. And here we are in a biomedical engineering lab focused on microfluidics, so very tiny volumes. And so my advisor, after that talk, he says, hey, you know, I think I found a cool application. But, you know, again, given that I had a first project that didn't work, he's giving me this other idea. And so he's like, okay, I don't know if it's going to work, but it'd be really cool if it could. Could you go, you know, try to figure it out? I started working with different collaborators across university, and we were able to figure it out after a couple of years. But along that way of figuring it out, then we had a discussion. He said, you know, the work that you're doing is really good, but if we're going to have you talk about this at conferences, and we should protect your work. And that's when he started the conversation about filing a provisional application. I didn't know what that meant. And imposter syndrome, me didn't want to be like, what is a provisional application? So I just went back to Google and said, Google, what is a provisional patch? And then he connected us to the commercialization office at University of Michigan, where they have patent attorneys who are skilled in that application of writing the provisional patent. So yeah, my first patent application was learning experience, you know, what figures do you write? Because again, and then again, you know, it's also part of my journey of not knowing. So I didn't know that you could file a provisional without for sure having your test working perfectly yet. And so my advisor was all, again, in the mentoring role, okay, just draw, you know, the method that we're hypothesizing is going to work. Use the photos that you generated showing, you know, the partitioning of the two different polymers. Use the preliminary results that you've gotten where you see the light, the signal, you know, showing that, you know, something did bind to something in a phase. So it's possible that you could have a reaction happening in the droplet. And so he sort of guided me through the process of what figures to add. And then when we sent it to the patent attorney and they sent it back, you know, the language is now very legal, legalese. And I'm like, that sounds so cool. Like, they just made my work sound so complicated. And I'm like, that is amazing. So that was my first provisional patent, I think. And then the second provisional happened maybe less than a year later, because now, again, you know, once you're exposed to something and you know how to do it, you know what to look for the next one. And the second one was really just, you know, an improvement on the first provisional, where now we're exploring different applications for the technology. And again, if we're going to publish or talk at conferences, we want to protect it. And so now that I'm thinking from what my professor said, it's like, oh, okay, well, this is another application. Should we protect that too? And so that's what led to the second provisional, which happened, you know, just a few months after the first.
It sounds like your advisor in graduate school was very much of an influence in your life and a tremendous mentor. What do you think it was that he saw in you?
I don't know. I promise I need to ask him one day, but I'm pretty sure if I ask him, he will tell me I'm overthinking. I think knowing him, that's just his personality. He sees your potential, or maybe he does. He knows that you have potential. You don't know it yet. And I think it's similar to what I do today with, you know, my work with invention education. Somebody, you need somebody in your life to speak something into you for you to start believing that you can do it. And I think that was his role in my life, was really just to speak to me, first of all, and say, join my lab, and then speak to me multiple times. And, you know, we still keep in touch today. He's a big supporter of Abby Invents, which I did not even know that he would buy children's books, given that he has no kids. But but he continues to support me. Even, you know, last February, I was invited to University of Michigan to deliver a keynote address. And I mentioned it to him via email, and he joined. And he's so busy. And he joined, and he had his entire lab call in. And I did not know he did that. I mean, he told me he was going to join. I thought it was just him. But after my talk, then one of the students forwarded me the email that he sent to the lab. And that was my first time seeing how highly he spoke about me, and the fact that he didn't just call, but he had a student's call, and I've graduated so many years ago. That just highlights to you how good of a mentor he is. He is the definition of what it means to be a mentor.
Do you think he has any idea how much influence he had in your life?
I hope so. I mean, I talk about him in every interview that I give. This is my way of giving him his flowers, just so he knows how much he's done for me. So I hope he does. Yeah.
I love what you just said, giving the flowers now. You know what? To be honest, Dr. Simon, people are actually calling April's name, right? We've shifted to that point. I'm proud to announce, I should have done this at the beginning. April is now our office managing partner of the second largest office within the firm. And we have some really, really large offices. She is now OMP of the San Francisco office. Kudos to her on that.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. You're going to make me blush.
Well, I feel like I've teased our audience long enough with the Abby and Vince line. I feel like I keep touching on it. And I'm like, nope, we're saving that for later. So tell us how you came up with the idea of Abby and Vince.
Well, okay. So when the day after I defended my dissertation at the University of Michigan, I invited my dad to my lab. It would be my last lab meeting that I would attend. And, you know, all the guys were cheering me on. They loved my thesis presentation. And, you know, it was a very heartwarming event. And we took a photo on that day. I am very short. And in that photo, you'll see me standing with 15 men in the background. That was the first time that we took a photo with just us. Usually it would be at a picnic where we have family and friends, but I had never seen a photo of how short I was compared to all the guys, and that I'm the only Black person of all the guys, the only girl at the front with all the guys. Anyway, we're walking back to my car, and my dad says, wait, are there other women in the lab? Because there were some guys who were still missing, okay? So he goes, are you the only woman in the lab? And I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I told you when the last woman left. That was 2 years ago. And he goes, huh, I didn't realize that you must have said it, but I probably didn't really realize that you were. So that conversation sort of stuck with me for a few years. And then I always, again, you know, going back to my childhood, wanting to be a teacher, right? You know, I'm now a biomedical engineer. I'm not thinking of becoming a professor, but I still have that desire to share the knowledge that I've learned. And I decided to write a children's book. And I wanted to basically write a letter or a story for my younger self. And that's why in the first title, Abby Invents Unbreakable Crayons, you see Abby, the very first image, is that she's in her class and her teacher introduces the class to inventor Maya Smart, who is a Black woman inventor. And Abby gasps because she says, she looks like me. And that, for me, was important. Representation matters at all levels, right? And now, because of that Abby meeting inventor Maya Smart, it has planted a seed in who she is. So when now she's trying to color with her crayons and they keep breaking, she knows that she's identified a problem. And what's left is to figure out how to solve that problem. And now she knows she can be an inventor, like inventor Maya Smart. And so Abby invents the world's first unbreakable crayons and gets her first patent. And then in the second book, I wanted to introduce the theme of collaboration, because many people think inventors work alone. And also, I invented a boy character, Miko, because many parents were asking me, where is the boy? To which I usually responded that I read Harry Potter and he's a boy, so I don't know why your old boy can't read about Abby, but sure. Black boys need some love too, so here comes Miko. And Miko's Abby's cousin. And the themes of my stories are really to show kids, okay, first we make a crayon. It's small. It's a kid invention. But I want Abby to grow technically through my stories. So my mission is really in every story, her inventions get more complicated, but it's simplified in such a way that kids can understand. Similar to how I talk to my dolls, how I spoke to kids in my mom's classroom, that desire to teach is still there. And so Abby and Miko come home from school. They see Abby's mom taking forever to fold laundry. And in the minds of a child, there are washing machines to wash the clothes. There are dryers to dry the clothes. So surely there should be folding machines to fold the clothes. And so Abby and Miko invent the world's first at-home laundry folding machine. And she gets her second patent. Now, the name Abby invents also has meaning. So Abby means gives joy. And invents comes from the Latin word inventus, to discover. So put it together, and Abby invents really means that there is joy in discovery. And so that's all that I want to show kids, really, is the magic of inventing, the joy of discovery, and that, you know, whatever problem that you see in the world, whether it be small, like crayons or a folding machine or whatever Abby invents next, it's possible. And you don't have to wait until you're 20-something like I was to know that you can be an inventor. You can be an inventor at your young age. And, you know, in my stories, I call kids future inventor. Again, affirmations, you know. For me, one of my earliest affirmations in undergrad was when I became a McNair scholar. So the Ronald E. McNair program is, you know, named after Dr. McNair, who is the second African-American to go to space. And his legacy lives on in McNair Scholars. So that program was what led me to get a doctorate degree. Before that, I mean, why would I want to get a doctorate degree? I didn't even know I could do that. So the program, every time I entered into that office, the admin assistants, the program directors, they all called me future Dr. Simon. For 3 years, they called me future Dr. Simon. And that is the power of affirmation and manifestation. Like, you hear it enough, you believe it, and the only thing left for you to do is just make it real. And so by calling kids future inventor in the books, whenever I sign the book, it's hello, future inventor. Whenever I speak to students, it's hello, future inventors. When I call my niece and nephew, I say hello, future inventor Sari. And, you know, my niece Sari, like, now she calls me and she says, hey, Auntie Arlene, you know, I had an idea for this invention for a face mask because I can't breathe with the mask. And I'm thinking maybe we can do that, that, that. And I'm like, do you realize how powerful that is? She's 8 and she's already thinking about inventing. Or my nephew will say like, hey, I invented this anti-itch cream. And I'm like, what is an anti-itch cream? Turns out all he did was go in the yard, you know, crush up some hibiscus leaves and pour some mentholate solution and mix some of my mom's lotion, which he didn't ask permission to do, and called it his anti-itch cream. But I mean, that is that all you have to do is just call kids future inventor and just see how much they sit up and they start seeing themselves as future inventors.
I know you won awards for Abby Invents the Foldybot. Can you talk about some of those awards?
Sure. So Purdue University, in their 2021 Engineering Gift Guide, they ranked Abby Invents the Foldybot as one of their top 10 engineering gifts for kids. The Smithsonian Magazine also rated as one of the top toys or gifts for kids in 2021. And most recently, Abby Invents the Foldybot is a finalist for the 2022 AAAS Subaru Best Children's Science Picture Book. So AAAS is the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And so I am like super jazzed because I'm just amazed because, you know, Abby Invents the Foldybot is self-published. And to be on a short list of 4 for this prestigious national award, and, you know, to have a review of Abby Invents the Foldybot in Science Magazine, you know, a top academic journal, it feels like maybe elements of my life are finally finding a way to connect, because I never expected a children's book getting a review in a scientific journal. So the feedback has been and continues to be overwhelmingly positive. And so I'm happy the story has resonated with so many parents and educators and kids, you know, always about reaching the kids. So I'm happy the awards means that more kids will get to be introduced to Abby's character and more kids will learn about inventing.
And it was self-published because it was actually rejected by publishers. Isn't that accurate? Which really goes to your perseverance and ability to just move past adversity.
That is correct. Yeah, that is true.
And the joke's on them. So there you go. Pushing
it. Well, one of the things that resonated with me when I read the books was how important it is to have adult support and encouragement and empowerment. I know that you were fortunate to have that with your family and obviously had an excellent mentor in your advisor in graduate school. But can you talk a little bit more about how incredibly important that is for kids?
Ah, so important. Your childhood is your formative years. Whatever you hear as a child, good or bad, is what you remember through your entire grown-up or adulthood. For me, I always heard stuff like, you're so bright, you have a bright future, such potential. And these are things that all kids should hear. So I am very intentional on making sure that with Abby Invents, I have affirmations like, you're a problem solver, you're an inventor, you solve problems big and small, you have great ideas. I mean, that is a dumbed down version of what my advisor told me in grad school, but that's literally how he made me feel, that no question I asked him was silly, that I have great ideas. And so I just want kids to know, no matter their income, no matter their race, that they have great ideas and it's up to them to share it. And whatever ideas they have, it is a great idea and they can make it become reality.
When I love that they had ideation meetings in the book and then also were crowdsourcing to get feedback. I just thought that was absolutely fabulous.
Oh yeah, they were definitely next level kids. They were. So, oh, this is great. Well, speaking of the next generation, Christina, I tell you, she's always the thinker. She's the true inventor and mastermind. She thinks of everything, but she partnered with our department at the firm, who has established a great partnership. I'll call her by name. We are calling everyone out and giving them their flowers. Katie Beecham. She is our director of community relations and all things. I'm butchering her title right now, mind you. I think she's like chief fill in the blank. So she's up there. But she's established or helped us to continue a partnership with the local school, the Barack and Michelle Obama Academy. Not too far from Georgia State, actually. So books were put into the hands, your books were put into the hands of each of these babies. And what they were able to do was come up with a list of questions. And we have the pleasure to read a few of their questions so that you can answer them live for them. April, do you want to kick those questions off?
Sure. The first question is from Kalia, who's in fifth grade and had a question about Foldybots. The question is Foldybots a real thing in real life?
Hello, future inventor Kalia. Thank you for asking this question. That is a very common question I get. Foldybots do not exist today. But the beautiful thing about Abby invents the Foldybot is Abby shows you the process that she went through to create her Foldybot. And what I challenge you to do is come up with your idea of how you would make your own Foldybot. Because everybody's idea of how to solve a problem is different. And your idea may be different from Abby's, but it may be just as feasible. And so I challenge you to create your Foldybot.
So the next question that we're going to read comes from Kalia, or maybe Kaylee. Has Abby created any other items other than the crayons and the Foldybot?
Hi, future inventor Kaylee. Yes. So Abby is currently working on her third invention. And Abby's third invention is all about tackling accessibility, making sure that, you know, some of us don't have all our limbs or not born with all our limbs. And so Abby wants to make everybody feel seen and appreciated. And Abby's next invention tackles accessibility.
The next question is from Mackenzie in fifth grade, also about unbreakable crayons. Her question, his or her question, is where does the story take place?
Wow, future inventor Mackenzie, I have never been asked this question before. I try not to say which country Abby is from because I want kids from all over the world to identify with elements of Abby's character. But I do believe in the third book, I will make Abby have Caribbean roots. So let's pretend that Unbreakable Crayons is not set in the Caribbean, but the third book more than likely will be based in the Caribbean. Maybe Abby travels there. I don't know yet. But Abby doesn't have a country per se that she belongs to. But that's a great question.
And then I think I'll tee up the next one, but I'll let Kim ask it. So we have a very precocious young man named Stevie, who's a third grader in Fayetteville, Georgia. And he had a question that his mother will ask you.
So I had the absolute pleasure of reading both books to the boys last night. Stevie, I had his full attention. He asked so many questions. I jotted them all down. To my dismay, this was the first question, but I've spoken with people, Christina in part, and others have told me, Kim, this is not a mom failure, that this was his first question. So brace yourself. Stevie, mommy loves you. How much money did Abby get for making the unbreakable crayons?
Oh, my God.
I told you he was precocious.
What? Okay. Future inventor, Stevie. You are definitely going to roll to be an entrepreneur. Wow. Abby, you know, I don't know how much Abby has made. I haven't considered.
Does she have a running royalty? Is that what it is?
Yeah, let's just say she has licensed the technology to Crayola. And for every crayon, every unbreakable crayon that Crayola sells, Abby gets 50 cents.
There you go. There you go. That's pretty great. No, it definitely opened up a great discussion between the two of us about monetizing inventions and the like. It took our discussion next level. So
I can't imagine, actually, because I have gotten asked from other educators whether I would take it a next step and show Abby being an entrepreneur and not just ending at patenting. And so a few educators and I have actually launched a program that's funded by the Lemelson Foundation called Invention Lit, where it's a free professional development workshop for K through five educators. It's so free that we actually pay them up to $500 to attend. But the purpose is to show educators how they can use any children's book. It doesn't have to be STEM related, to bring invention and entrepreneurship to the classroom. And so we leverage, you know, the engineering design process and, you know, what I've shown with Abby Invents, and show that even if you're reading a child a book like Cinderella, you can still guide the child to identify problems to solve in a story. And by problems, I don't mean grammatical problems, but, you know, Cinderella loses her glass slipper, she's on a carriage. Are there things in the story that kids can relate to that maybe can, you know, garner like a brainstorming discussion? Some teachers are not comfortable teaching science and invention and entrepreneurship in the classroom because they're not formally trained in those disciplines, but they teach English. And so we're trying to show them that even if they teach English, you can still teach science in an open-ended fashion. So Stevie's is onto something here.
Well, And I don't want to, you know, try to tell you what you could potentially do, but it sounds like there might be a character named Stevie that could maybe be in the entrepreneurship book. I'm just throwing it out there. I don't have any personal. Yeah, I don't have any personal interest in that at all. I know earlier you said that you wrote the Abby Invents and it's a story to your younger self. I'd like to ask you if you could talk to your younger self and give advice about what it's like to be a first or an only that we could pass on to the next generation, if you could do that for us.
Well, I would tell my younger self that, you know, you have a bright future. There may be challenges along the way where you are alone or you feel lonely, but you may be lonely, but you're never alone because you carry with you all the lessons that you learned from your childhood. You carry with you all the love from your family and your teachers. And that love and that curiosity is really what sort of motivates you to keep pressing on, even if at times you may feel alone. And I would also tell my younger self the same thing that Abby's mom told her in the Foldybot. Everyone starts off as a beginner. You can do it. Just start. Because many times, many of us are so afraid of starting a new chapter, trying a new field. We're afraid of failure. We're afraid of rejection. But we forget that everybody starts off from a place of not knowing. And you have to trust yourself that you can learn. It may take you 6 months. It may take you a year. But you're going to learn. And then you're going to look back and just be completely amazed at how much you learned in that time. And once you expose yourself to a new opportunity, a new learning, then now the world is your oyster. And now you want to learn something new. And it just keeps growing and growing. So follow your curiosity and don't be afraid to start, even if you are alone.
I think that would be great advice for adults as well. Yeah. Really, really appreciate it. It was an absolute pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you
so much for sharing everything with us and our listeners.
Thank you for inviting me. This was good. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed Sidebars, we invite you to check out the Kilpatrick Townsend Medicine and Molecules blog at kilpatricktownsend.com to read, watch, and listen to other related insight on patent law. We'll also put that information in the show notes. The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and are not those of Kilpatrick Townsend.
Also, we would love it if you would rate us or leave a review. It helps others find the show. See you next time.